morning, everyone. My name is Jack Evans, Chairman of the Board of the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, and I'd like to welcome everyone to a special meeting of the board. I want to stress it's a special meeting, not an emergency meeting, not any other kind of meeting, because generally the board in the past has not met in August. So we are having a special meeting in August to really address many of the concerns, issues, incidents that have been happening involving Metro over the last several months. It was clear to myself and a number of board members in July that there were things happening. The way our schedule runs, we would not have had another board session until September 8th and not another board meeting and safety meeting until September 22nd and or September 20th. And consequently, we felt that it was important to get together now and get on top of what's happening. So I appreciate the number of board members who are here. I had an opportunity to speak with almost everyone, and there was a lot of support for moving forward today and doing this. The way I'd like to conduct the meeting today is I'll make some introductory comments. Mr. Riedefeld will give us a briefing, and his staff, welcome both all of you here today, will give us an overview of what's been happening, a briefing on the red light incidents, the red light running incidents, the train derailment in Falls Church, the police officer involved with the ISIS group, and even yesterday's report that was issued by the FTA on not using brakes and train cars that aren't secured, et cetera. So as much information as you can give us on those, we'd appreciate. And then the board members will have an opportunity to ask questions. So to bring some order, what we'll do is have five-minute rounds. And I've sent out a list of the order of people that I'll just call on. If you have questions, that's good. If you don't, then you can just pass to the next person. There is a rhyme and reason to this list. It starts with the voting members in the order of which we hold these positions. So it'd be myself, Katura, Jim, and then David. And then, again, the next set of voting members. But since Corbett's not here, Lace is in his spot, and then the non-voting members by order of seniority. So there is some rhyme and reason for this. Each member will have 5 minutes to ask questions. There's a clock someplace that will come on. There it is here. At the end of 5 minutes, I appreciate you passing on to the next member. If you don't, I will hit the gavel and ask you to move on to the next member. We'll do one round, and if people still have questions, we'll do a second round. And if people still have questions, we'll do another round. I would like to ask everyone, though, if we could possibly be finished by noon today. That gives us 2 hours, because we have an executive board meeting upstairs as well. So with that, I'd like to get ready to begin. Before I do, I'd like to recognize that we are joined by our congressperson, Barbara Comstock from Virginia. Welcome to the meeting, and thank you for being a very big supporter of WMATA. I want to begin by, I brought a photo with me, because I think it's important. And this is a picture of me in an airplane as the co-pilot of an F-16. June 22nd, 2009, the pilot of that plane, I brought a picture of him too, right here. And he was a friend of mine, flew the plane. His name was Major General David Worley. And on that date, June 22nd, 2009, he was killed at Fort Totten along with his wife in a Metro train. Okay? I take this very seriously because even at the time, I was very saddened about it, but only today, after being on sport for last year, I realized how much that should never have happened. But after that incident, Metro was going to be committed to safety. We're going to spend, which we did, about $3 billion. But yet again, in January 12th of 2015, Carol Glover, and I mentioned her name because she wasn't just some woman, Carol Glover suffocated to death on the floor of a Metro train. Okay? So now we had 9 people killed at Fort Totten, another person killed last year. And still, here we are. Yesterday, a report issued by the FTA that Metro cars are not secure, the brakes aren't being put on, and there's just negligence taking place. And I just have to say here today, this has got to stop. It's just got to stop. And I know all of us on the board, most of us are new, I know General Manager and his staff, most of whom are new, are all committed to this. And I just want to say to everyone, to the public, riders, the elected officials in this region, to everyone, that we are committed to fixing Metro. We are committed to doing that no matter how long it takes, no matter how much money it costs. We are committed to fixing Metro. Because when Metro doesn't work, nothing works. So whether you ride Metro, whether you've never been on Metro in your life, it doesn't matter. When Metro doesn't work, nothing works. It means that cars are going to be congested on roads. It means that people won't get to work. It means that people won't be able to go downtown or go to the suburbs. It means nothing works. So we are committed to making this happen. So I want to thank you all for coming out here today. This is the first of many meetings like this we are going to have because the board is very engaged and is going to stay on top of this until we make sure that we correct every problem with Metro. So thank you, and Mr. Wiedefeld.
Good morning, Chairman. Thank you, and thank the board for their engagement. I do want to introduce some of the new staff. Joe Leader, who's my new COO, has been with us almost a month now. He actually joined us right before the derailment. He was to start the Monday afterwards. He came down that weekend to help us out. Also, you know, Pat Lavin, the new safety officer, you know, the Chief Pavlik, and then Patty Lee, our new general counsel, is here as well. Again, as the chairman said, we're going to hit on three things. The FBI arrest of one of our officers. Again, that's under investigation. I know that's not a term that the board wants to hear, but in a case like that, obviously, we cannot go very far, but we will let you know what we can let you know now. We will also present some information on the red signal overruns. As you recall, just last month at the safety committee, there was a full presentation on that, and so we're sort of doing a crosswalk between what the FTA just came out with and what we're doing about it, and it ties to a lot of what we talked about last time. And then we're going to talk about the East Falls Church derailment. And it's around three areas there. One is the actual safety investigation that Pat will talk about, and then Joe will talk about the corrective actions we're doing, and some of them have been underway and some of them that are new. And then let me just talk a little bit about the police investigation. I believe it was last Friday the 12th, I believe, that Joe was doing his investigation, and we were getting some conflicting information and disturbing information from some of the interviews we were doing. At that time, he contacted the chief. They came to me, presented what they were starting to find, and at that point, I worked with our general counsel and said, look, I want to move this to a different level, and I don't know what, if there's been any crime, but we're going to get to the root of the issues. And just like the chairman just said, we're not going to ignore these things. We're going to tackle them, and they will lead where they will lead. This is not against union. This is not management. This is about individual accountability, and that is the standard that we are putting out here. And we're going to do whatever it takes, and it will lead where it leads. So that's what that is about. So again, we're not going to go very far into that. I can't go very far into that. We don't want any statements that we all make to jeopardize anything that may come out of that, but I think it does reflect the seriousness that we take and the commitment we're taking to, again, individual accountability for the safety of our customers and our fellow employees. So that is what we will do. With that, I was going to turn it over to Pat first, both to do a safety contact and then get into the red line, the red tube over.
I'm just going to give a very brief safety contact. In the event of an emergency, there's exits in that corner to my left and to my right. There's also fire extinguishers out there. If we have to leave in the event of an emergency, we're going to rally across the street. There's a museum there, the Architecture Museum. If anyone needs it, there's an AED behind the guard booth directly outside. There's also bathrooms there if anyone needs it. With that, I'm going to start the red signal violation presentation. Okay, the red signal violation report came out of the FTA doing three safety blitzes over the summer. They focused on vehicle securement, track integrity, and, of course, the red signal violations. That directive was issued on August 15th. It contained six findings and 11 required actions. WMATA has 30 days to respond and 60 days to submit corrective action plans. I'd also like to point out that the FTA issued an industry-wide safety advisory on stop signal overruns. That advisory directs each property to collect more information on overruns so that you can do greater analysis to get to the root cause of these events. safety directive focused on four main categories, the first one being mainline and yard familiarization. As I presented last month in detail, there are many actions underway. Those include validation and providing mainline and yard signal reference maps to all operators. Those include revenue operators and work train operators. Revised pre-operational checklist, line familiarization training being developed, and the development of a standard operation procedure that gives guidance to train operators when they encounter a red signal. Category two is movement with zero speed commands. The actions being taken, once again, the line and yard familiarization, development of operation training curriculum, development of an efficiency testing and compliance program to identify these events when they're occurring, installing point of power stickers, and the development of engineering solutions, as well as ongoing fatigue awareness education. Category three is communication protocols. And a lot of the incidents we've identified as either a lack of communication or poor communication capabilities. And in that vein, we've issued a directive that gives clear communication that requires a word-for-word feedback. That's also developing a communication course that will also require 100% feedback. We're identifying locations where there are limited coverage, and we have an overarching program towards upgrading the entire system with better radio communication. Category four is the investigation. I think one of the things I pointed out very early upon my arrival here is that the lack of a dedicated investigation unit. I've been funded for those heads, so we're trying to build the investigation unit, and part of that is also, as earlier mentioned in the FDA safety advisory, is to capture more data as we catalog these events to use that for greater trend analysis. If anyone has any questions, I'll move on to the East Falls
Church. Keep going on, and we'll get to the questions after you're finished.
Okay. East Falls Church derailment. These are basically factual statements from what we've identified thus far. The incident occurred at 6:14 a.m. on Friday, July 29th. It was an outbound Silver Line train, a six-car consist. It was four 3,000 series cars and two 5,000 series cars in the consist. The train derailed at East Falls Church in Hawaii. This is a graphical display that gives you the physical characteristics of the plant. The train was crossing from track one to track two. The rear truck of the number four car, which was a 3,000 series car, and the front truck of the number five car derailed. That was a 5,000 series K car. As a result of the derailment, 63 passengers were safely evacuated to the roadbed. Three passengers reported injuries. One of those individuals had to be transported with non-life-threatening injuries. The damage cost associated with this event are pending. As far as breaking down each of the areas that we analyzed thus far, we did not find any defects in the signal system, the rail vehicles, or the power distribution system. There did not appear to be any operator concerns from an operational standpoint, nor did we identify at this point any rock concerns. There were no fatigue or common-hour service issues as well. What we did identify is a wide gauge track defect. The track ties that supported the rail were deteriorated to a point where they were unable to restrain the lateral forces produced by the train crossing it, which essentially means that the rail spread and the wheels dropped in. The ongoing investigation is focusing on track maintenance and inspections. What we found is that there was a failure to maintain the interlocking to the track and structure standards, there was a failure to inspect the track to internal standards, and defects were incorrectly classified. These are the dates of the last inspections that were performed. The track geometry was performed in February of 2016. The ultrasonic testing was partially done. It was performed in April 2016. And what we identified is that the TGV vehicle, the component that does the ultrasonic testing, was not functioning. Therefore, there was 800 feet of track that was not tested. That 800 feet was hand-tested to ensure safety. So the system, from a reliability standpoint, was tested, but 800 feet was not ultrasonically tested. But the track inspections, the last track inspection occurred on track 1 on July 27th. The last track inspection occurred on track 2 on July 11th. Riding inspections were performed due to high rail temperatures. So what that means is you're required to inspect track twice a week. Some of the inspections were occurring on the ground. Other of the inspections were occurring as a riding inspection due to the high temperatures experienced during that time frame. The detailed inspection, the last detailed inspection, which is required to be performed every 30 days, was last done on June 17th, and that would have been when the measurements in the crossover should have been taken. I just wanted, for the edification of whoever's listening, the standards that WMATA has, as far as I can tell, are appropriate standards. The issues here is training and enforcing compliance to these standards. So you can see where WMATA, the different types of testing we do and how that stacks up against FRA. So we either meet or exceed FRA standards. The issue is compliance. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Joe Lita, the new Chief Operating Officer.
Thank you. Since this is my first time addressing the board, I'd just like to take 30 seconds to give you an idea of where I came from or my background. Earlier this year, I retired as Senior Vice President for New York City Transit. Over my 30-year career, I rose through the ranks in both operations and safety. I started my career as an intern, superintendent intern in the Division of Track. I worked my way up through track maintenance, construction, as well as the inspection group. My career path also allowed me to work into other areas of the agency, like the Office of System Safety. I spent 3 years as the Director of Investigation, both on the bus and the rail side. And my final 5 years, I worked as the Vice President for Maintenance Away, and my last 2 years, I worked as the Senior Vice President. My first day on the job here at Metro was supposed to be Monday, August 1st, but when I learned of the derailment, or I was notified of the derailment, I came in on that Saturday so I could get an assessment of the site and to find out how we were progressing with our investigation and what was the cause of the derailment. Based on my observation, and through consultations with Andy Orth, as well as Pat Lavin, my first actions I took were to initiate special inspections of our mainline interlockings. We have 66 interlockings, 271 switches. I wanted to make sure that they were in good shape. From those inspections, the concentration was on component degradation. So we were looking at our fasteners and we were looking at our ties. Any conditions that were identified at that time were prioritized and remediation was scheduled. And finally, based on the results of those inspections, that's what changed the philosophy in safe track. As you know before, many of our safe tracks were just single tracks for maybe 9 days, 16 days. What we're doing now is where we have interlocking that need work, we're taking the interlocking out of service over the weekend to make sure that when we leave that area, not only is the track that we originally scheduled our safe tracks on, that is done complete, but also our interlockings have been upgraded and completed. Next, I asked my track supervisors to go back and look at all the priority one defects that were open in the system to make sure that they were still safe and that the conditions remained status quo. And finally, this week, we started our last inspection or initiative inspections. We're inspecting all our sharp curves throughout our system. We have 110 sharp curves, and we started that this past Monday. From a track standpoint, these are the most vulnerable areas in any system. And I repeat, any system is your special work area. And I want to make sure that we have a good grasp on, you know, what those conditions are in these areas. That's right. Next, I requested local management to hold town hall meetings with our track inspectors. And the first thing we did was we introduced for our track inspectors a new form. And this new form requires the inspector to put more detailed information regarding the condition they see and their reporting out there. We also reinforced the requirement that when you enter a crossover area, not only do you concentrate your inspection on the mainline side, but that you're also inspecting, as part of our standards, the crossover itself. And finally, we re-instructed all the track inspectors how to properly perform our 30-day or a monthly inspection of our interlockings. Next, I wanted to ensure we had the appropriate level of oversight over the track inspection program. So therefore, I instituted new track inspection requirements to make sure that our track supervisors, our assistant superintendents, and our superintendents were concentrating on the defective conditions that need immediate replacement. Next slide. Next, to ensure that our track program is meeting industry best standards and to guide us towards making permanent and effective change, I requested a third-party consultant be brought in to review our current work processes. The first priority will be to develop a detailed in schedule of all of our inspections. That's our visual inspections as well as our automated inspections. Second, they are to mentor our track inspectors, and they started this work this past weekend. And third, they will be reporting back to myself and my staff on the what they find out there, what progress they're making, and if there's any other issues that we missed and that we need to address. And this team of six are all FRA qualified track inspectors. And again, they started this past Monday, the 22nd, and they have been on the track with our track inspectors. Next slide. Prior to my arrival, I would like to report that there are actions already underway to address recognized deficiencies in the track inspection program in the areas of training, surveying of asset conditions, as well as concerns surrounding our maintenance manuals. In regards to training, in September, we have the University of Tennessee that will be coming on site to give our track inspectors a one-week training program. We're going to hold two of those sessions, so all our track inspectors and our supervisors will be going through that. And finally, by September 9th, we will have awarded a contract to a third party who will help rebuild our entire track walker training program. And finally, we had two contracts that were awarded this past summer. One team is closely surveying the condition of our tracks and rebuilding our database of defects. And this information will be used to drive our capital program in the future. And this is the best practice that is used by many of the agencies, and it was also used in New York, performing a cyclotype inspection from an engineering standpoint to find out where we should be putting our resources in the future. And finally, the other contract is reviewing and rewriting our track standards manual. Next slide. What are our next steps? We are now moving to complete the safety investigation, and upon completion, we will implement all corrective actions that need to be done. I'm also bringing Ramada's quality assurance team into play. Currently, they are auditing us on State Track. I've asked them now to come into our track maintenance, start looking at our processes and procedures to make sure that we're following them. And we will begin pursuing the use of new technology. What I'm asking is that we look at high-definition video as a way of enhancing our track inspection program. So with that, I would like to thank you for this time and open the floor up to any questions.
Chief. Hold on. Sorry. Go ahead. Good morning, Mr. Evans and members of the board. First and foremost, I would like to publicly thank the men and women of the FBI, especially Mr. Paul Bate. Mr. Paul Bate is the assistant director in charge of the Washington Field Office. But from the time we notified the FBI to request their assistance and support us to the time Mr. Young was arrested, the partnership and the open lines of communication was phenomenal, keeping me abreast the entire time. The next thing I'd like to say is, you know, the safety and security of our employees and our riders are always our utmost top priority. If Mr. Young ever posed an immediate threat to any of our employees or our riders, plans are in place to mitigate that quickly. Mr. Young was employed on April 21st, 2003, and he served in our Patrol Operations Bureau. His performance during that 13 years was below average to average, never to a point that would rise to a termination. As you may have recalled in the Department of Justice press release that came out on August 3rd, Mr. Young associated with two individuals who were subsequently arrested and charged with federal-related charges of terrorism. At that point in time, he also began interacting with what he believed was an individual wanting to travel overseas to aid ISLI forces, but in reality, he was speaking with an undercover officer. I do want to take a minute and talk about our hiring process and our background process and what does that look like. Article 76 of the Wilmot Compact states that MCPD officers must meet or exceed the standards of the signatories in which we police. Typically, the state of Maryland has the highest standards, so that's the standard we always meet. Once an applicant successfully passes the written and the physical agility test, they begin our comprehensive hiring process, which includes a medical exam, a complete psychological exam, an oral interview board, which is chaired by a trained police official and two officers, a truth verification exam. Similar to a polygraph, we use what they call computer voice stress analyzer, or CVSA exam, similar to a polygraph, but it's a truth verification exam. We do fingerprinting on a local, state, and federal level. We do a complete criminal history check, a credit check, education verification, and references. Again, if at any point in time if Mr. Young's behavior was so escalated to a point where he was going to take action or immediate action, steps were in place to mitigate that as quickly as possible. Thank you. Okay, is that it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you all very much for your statements. Now we'll go to questions from board members. As I said at the offset, we have actually all 16 board members are present or on the phone, so everybody's here. Kathy Hudgens and Paul Smegberg are listening by conference, and they are available to ask questions as well. So we'll start with myself. I'll have 5 minutes. When I'm done, we'll go to Keturah and then down the list here. Okay? So first I want to focus on the train derailment at Falls Church. And so in reading about what happened, we're told that the tracks came apart, and that's why the train derailed. So the two questions in kind of layman's terms are, how did the tracks come apart? And I understand that over a period of time, the things that hold the tracks together wore out and they came apart. And then the obvious question is, if the tracks came apart and the things wore out, and the pictures I saw, that if, even if I were walking down the tracks, I would be able to say, oh my gosh, there's a problem here. How did we not find it? And this, I don't hate to ask compounded questions because this leads to the next question. There was an inspection report, and the question is, was the inspection report done, or was it falsified and they actually didn't inspect the tracks? So could you kind of address that series of questions? How did this happen? How did we not find it? And do we have evidence that they actually never inspected it?
With regard to your first question, the reason why the track spread is there are rail plates or fasteners that hold the rail in place. Those were secured by cut spikes, and those cut spikes were driven into rail ties. The rail ties were deteriorated to a point where they had split, were basically ineffective in restraining it. That allowed the plates or the fasteners to shift out. The rails went beyond gauge, and that allowed the rail to drop in. From an inspection standpoint, they're required to inspect those tracks twice a week. I believe the perception was, which is incorrect, and which is not in conformance with standard, is that as they walk through those areas, they're not only supposed to walk the straight or tangent track, they are supposed to walk into the crossover midway, examine the tracks in those areas, and then continue on with the walk. That, I do not believe, was occurring properly. And in addition to that, they're supposed to do a 30-day inspection where they physically install a gauge and they measure at certain defined coordinates the gauge of the track. I do not believe that they were complying with that as defined inside the standards of WMATA's TRIST 1000 manual.
Okay. So essentially, we weren't doing the inspections we should have been doing.
They were not doing them in conformance with what the standards require.
Okay. And then again, as far as the inspection reports, this was done in June. Was the report done? Was the inspection done? Was the report falsified?
I can't speak to the falsification piece of it, but there was a report that was submitted. And based upon some of the documents we saw in the internal conversations, that's why we requested Ron do an independent look at it as well.
Okay. And one of our shop stewards is a question. Track supervisors, managers, and superintendents tried to get into that area before the derailment and were told by the rock that they couldn't do that. Is there any validity to that? Do we know anything about that?
Yes. There was a request to do the inspection, the detailed inspection, which would have been a 30-day inspection. I don't remember the exact date, but it was within a couple days prior to the derailment. And they were not allowed in there because there was a single tracking operation that was occurring. When you single track, you generally do not put employees on the tracks in those circumstances. It is my understanding that they were supposed to reschedule that inspection to occur off tour on the midnight hours. However, the derailment had happened within 1 or 2 days after that request had been made, and they did not do the midnight inspection.
Okay. And now how widespread is this? All right, it happened at Falls Church. Is this a one-off? Somehow they didn't get it done there, but everything else throughout the system with similar setups was being taken care of. Do we know the answer to that?
Yes, and I'll let Joe speak about the special inspection we did.
All right.
In the office. Is that fair?
Yeah.
As I said, after the derailment, I ordered a special inspection. Fine conditions, some were noted. As we performed our investigation, one of the things we looked at is, what were the conditions we found during the special inspections? Does it mirror the inspections that were being handed to us? And that's part of the investigation that's going on right now. As I mentioned in my opening statement, you know, those remedial actions were taken. Anything that was considered a priority, we have now taken care of. In fact, tomorrow will be the last day when we finish the last segment.
All Okay. So you're confident, as we sit here today, that we've looked at all the areas of our system like this and that the tracks are not coming apart, that we won't have derailments because of the situation?
In regards to our interlocking inspection,
yes.
And as I said in my statement, this past Monday, we began our last special inspections, which will be of our curves.
Okay.
And we should be done by the end of this month.
Okay. So as of today, by the end of this month, we should be in a situation to say this won't happen again.
Good.
Okay. All right. Thank you. My time's up. Katura?
Thank you. And thank you for your presentation. I just have a couple of follow-ups based on what Jack was raising. Are these track inspections primarily are done on foot?
The way our inspection program works is we have visual inspections, which are done on most of them are done on walking, and we also have automated inspections, which are our geometry car that will do dynamic loading testing, and there's other vehicles that we use to help us understand what's happening to our track system.
So was the TGV used in this area within a recent time span?
What's your part of your investigation?
Yeah, it's in the presentation. It was run in February of 2016. If you look at an FRA standard or an APTA standard, they require this inspection to be done once a year. WMATA does it twice a year. So the geometry testing was done. The ultrasonic testing was done as well over the entire system, and then it had malfunctioned. It was about 800 feet that were not done through ultrasonic testing that we went out and physically field verified and hand tested anything that we saw that looked like a discrepancy from standard.
And if I could, we're currently doing our second for the year in geometry testing right now.
So,
the entire system.
So you said the rail ties were split, correct? How long, based on the conditions in that area, would that process generally take?
Well, generally with rail ties to degrade to that point, it takes quite a while for that to come. Probably maybe over a course of years, but perhaps. There was a document, it was documented in the defect database that there was a defect out there. I believe it was classified as a P2 defect, which means less severe in my mind, and we're still validating everything I'm saying. That defect should have been upgraded to a black, and that interlocking should have perhaps been taken out of service.
So the track inspection team that inspects that particular area, is that their general rotation? Does it change? One track inspection team does one area, another does another. Is it happening with the same group of people that they're noticing the defects, or is there a conglomerate of different track inspection groups that are noting the same defects and reporting it the same way?
There are roughly 59 track inspectors throughout WMATA territory. The inspectors that were involved in that area, I believe they're assigned to that geographic area. The investigation is far from over. We're looking at all the areas that you brought up.
Okay. So just a suggestion going forward in the future, would it be helpful to randomize the track inspections per investigatory group to get another set of eyes on a problem that is consistently being reported by the same group?
I believe that was a function of that should have been occurring by supervision and is not occurring at the level it should have, because they should be going out and field verifying these defects, which is one of the actions we immediately took.
Okay.
And if I just may add, the special inspections that were performed were not performed by the supervisors from the inspection group. We pulled in supervisors from our maintenance group and our construction group. So that we had a different set of eyes looking at it. They were also supported by track engineers when they performed these special inspections.
Is there any concern that the supervisors that are reviewing these inspections are part of the problem?
We're taking a look at the entire organization to see what the problem is.
Thank you. No further questions.
Okay, thank you. Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to follow up a little bit with, I think, where Katura was going on this, and I'm going to move away from necessarily the East Falls incident and more to what was in the last FTA report. where personnel and management was not following the written standards for the trains in, that are stored, whether overnight or long-term. And it basically said back in the 1970s or 1980s, it was determined that it was kind of too hard to do this if we needed to move trains early on. And so since that time, they haven't followed these standard operating procedures. Has anyone on staff ever written, hey, don't worry about those standard operating procedures, or is this just throughout the system not paying attention to it?
I'm not aware of any written.
Yeah, I when I first got here, they were responding to some of the concerns from the FTA. There was a thought that that was acceptable to you know, because based upon you would need so many different events to happen for you to have a rollaway. When I kind of got involved, I think we examined it a little more detailed, and we agreed with the FTA that there should be hand brakes applied to trains that are not equipped with parking brakes like the 7000 series.
Okay. So
I think it has become an institutional practice.
Never written, just institutionalized. So I guess my real question is, Paul, for you gentlemen, thank you for your great reports. What else is not being followed? And that seems to be throughout the system, there are standards that are just not followed. Who's responsible? And so I ask that question, who is responsible? And I'll follow that with what actions have been taken already with personnel and with management, aside from the meeting that took place?
Yeah, a number of things there. One is some of these standards have not been followed for decades, in some cases, and years, and it has been institutionalized, rationalized, whatever. Some of the changes that were made were a result of that. Some of the changes that particularly Joe just went through, the things that we're doing to change that. The investigation is getting to the core of that issue, which is we have standards. Why aren't they being followed? And who's responsible for that? So that, again, that is getting it down to the individual accountability to do what actually are the standards that we've committed to. So that is exactly what we are doing. That's what we're going to do. Either we follow the standards, or you just do not work here.
Have any actions been taken to this point? I know there was a dismissal based on the train that was going the wrong way. Was that in July or was that June?
Again, the current investigation, we will take every necessary step that we have at our disposal once that's completed.
Okay. Thank you. David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to follow a little up on sort of Jim's question and direction. Just to give just a little context and perspective, I spent, a large part of my career dealing in auto safety issues, which, last year we lost over 35,000 people in traffic crashes. One of the reasons and one of the solutions to try to reduce the number of crashes and fatalities is to get people to drive less, which is to get people to take transit more. And the issues that I see, in contrast to the engineering of a car where there's a notion of Six Sigma, perfection and defects and things of that nature, when we cross-apply to an engineering task in transit, it really is, frankly, the public relying upon the work that you and your teams do. And the issue that I have in looking at this is that all of these sort of individual things that the board members have been talking about play into the continuing theme, which is there is an embedded culture which is continually rising these individual problems, wherever they may be. And ultimately, we're dealing with fighting a lack of faith in the system, which frankly will undo long-term plans of how we sort of deal with some of our biggest public health and safety issues. And this is sort of a longer range thing, I think, where Jim was going to, but what is the long range plan to change this culture? I know individual accountability is important.
there's only so many hammers and so many nails to go around. At the end of the day, there's going to have to be a cross current of responsibility built in to, frankly, every employee at Mulmata, and it's just not there. Mr. Wiedefeld, what is the long-range plan so that we are, so it isn't just simply individual accountability and punishing wrongdoing where we actually have a self-policing culture where we don't deal with these things on one-off?
Now that's exactly what we've been working on is, when I came here, there has been years of a disconnect between management and frontline employees, and that's a large effort of mine is to basically reinforce that we are all together in this, that we respect each other, we don't have retaliation. Some of the things I just did even recently on nepotism, policies on ethics, all those things are all, parts of this sort of culture over time. But basically, doing this, if you have standards, you follow them. That's not, that shouldn't have to be, it's just the norm, that we should all be under. So I think it is a major reset of how we approach our employees, and then also how we hold everyone accountable. And I think that, starts with me and goes down, throughout the entire organization. So I know there's not a one, one thing that, I would do and it would all flip. It's a combination of all these things. And I think it's also a function of the board, that basically, we are all in this together, and the chairman said that many times, is that, this isn't me, it isn't, it's all of us, working on this. And I know that the organization isn't moving that way, because in the thousands of employees I've talked to, they want that, they want to get there. Okay, on the orange line, where we had fasteners, and what did we do? We basically stopped it, we went to single tracking in the middle of peak period, several months ago, I don't think we do that. So that's how it starts.
No, I completely agree, and I also appreciate the fact that that your teams are reaching out to other safety organizations like the FAA and others to think about how we can sort of think about our best practices as well and how we evolve. Thank you, Mr. Wiedefeld. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you, Leif.
Thank you. I'm going to focus my first round of questions on the track inspection program. I see from your presentation that APTA performed a peer review in April. I haven't seen that peer review. Are we going to make that public?
We will, definitely. Yes.
Okay, good. With regard to industry benchmarking, I see from the FTA's track integrity investigation report that distances that were set for the track inspection segments have been reduced so that no segment is above six miles. So on average, the segments are 4.3 miles. Can you speak to the balance between the quantity of work that a track inspector team can perform? I understand they're in groups of two. The quantity of work that they can perform in a work day and the quality of that work, is that something that we've benchmarked against other systems?
Just coming from New York, one thing that Washington Metro has is you don't have as many guarded curves. They're, for the most part, long sweeping curves and tangent track. That is somewhat a benefit towards the track inspector. In New York, if you had an area that you had a lot of interlockings or switches and guarded curves, your section would be much smaller. But a section of about 4.3 miles is not considered out of the ordinary for a track inspector to walk.
Okay. So then can we get into the second part of that question, which is the quality of the inspection? I take it from your presentation and the reference to the contract to bring on board six FRA certified inspectors that we need help in terms of the the caliber of the inspection force that we have. So you're contracting out to bring on additional staff. So that's over and above the 59 that we have?
Correct.
Okay. And 41% of our inspectors have two or fewer years of service in that particular position. That would seem that we have a relatively inexperienced workforce.
But a lot of agencies are going through that right now as people attrit out for whatever reason, they get promoted or they're retiring. So to have a workforce that's somewhat new is going to happen. I think the best thing we can do is work on our training, make sure our standards are good, but make sure that the training that we give our inspectors is appropriate. The idea of bringing in the FRA group to oversee was really to establish a schedule and make sure not only the visual inspections are being performed properly and on time, but also to make sure our automated schedules are being done properly. And that was a concern of mine, especially the what we call the 30-day monthly inspections. I want to make sure that they are done within 30 days. So I want to make sure that they're scheduled on a routine basis. So that was the idea of bringing in that outside group to assist in that that fashion. But also, when you look at them, they're retired employees from other agencies, from SEPTA, from Amtrak. So they have a tremendous amount of experience, have worked in the inspections group. So I think they will bring, some mentorship towards our inspectors, which is, I think, well needed.
If I could add, also, this is not just aimed at truck inspectors. It's supervisors, it's management. You know, this is just not the inspectors. This is a broader issue.
Okay, so the six, are the six track inspectors who are going to be actually performing inspections, or are they augmenting your supervisory ranks?
They're not really augmenting. We're not replacing any supervisors. What they're there is to be a second set of eyes. So they're out there also mentoring. So if they see stuff, they will bring it to the attentions of the whoever it is, whether it's an inspector or a supervisor, bring it back to management and my team, what they're seeing out there. So it's actually having a second set of eyes.
Okay. How did you guys arrive at six? That's about a 10-to-1 ratio between in-house and contractor. Why not 5-to-1?
Well, actually, one of them is the lead.
Okay.
There's five actually that are out there. So one is considered the track engineer lead.
Okay. Well, I'm glad the general manager brought up the issue of supervision, because the FTA in their report noted that track supervisors are supposed to perform three field checks a week, but historically that has not taken place. According to your presentation today, the supervisors of the supervisors, so the superintendent, is expected to perform three inspections a week, and the assistant superintendent is to perform about 9 inspections a week. If the track inspector, which is the third rung of the supervisory rank, currently can't perform three field inspections a week, what is going to change such that the superintendent and the assistant superintendents are going to be out there in the field as much as you guys just represented to us?
The intent was to ensure that the superintendents and the assistants and the assistant superintendents are aware of the priority defects in their area. We want to make sure there's a communication that's happening between them, their supervisor, and the track inspector, that they're fully aware of what their inspectors are finding, okay, and making sure that they're on top of those locations. I think throughout a 5-day week, as a manager, that's doable. They're not asked to walk the entire sections, but they're asked to walk and be aware of the locations of where those defects are.
Okay, Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this first round, gentlemen, I'd like to just focus on the red light running incident and the FTA report on that. And just to start off, this was a subject of a presentation that Pat Laban made at our meeting last time in the exchange of the deal of information on that. And Mr. Laban and I have had some communication since then, which I want to just go into, but I want to start by saying that I just find as a board member and just as a citizen that the idea that train operators run red lights is incomprehensible to me. As a driver, I have to obey red light signals. As a truck driver, they obey red light signals. Our metro bus drivers obey red light signals. Why, when you're a train operator with 400 or 500 people in back of you, you suddenly decide that from time to time you don't have to obey red light signals is mind-boggling to me. But as it is, when we had our dialogue last week and I followed up with you, what I learned is that in our automatic train operation system, which we sometimes use right now or for certain red line trains, I guess, of eight car trains. And we hope to go back to it for the other lines at some point in the future, I assume. Even when a operator goes through a red light, he can still keep moving that train down the track as long as he's going under 12 miles an hour. Am I still correct in that? That's how the system works?
You're not 100% correct. It's only if you're in a what's called a stop and proceed mode, and you can go 12 miles an hour. If you're in ATO, you would be stopped.
So if you're in ATO, you would be stopped.
Automatic train operation, you would be stopped. It's only at a slow speed, stop and proceed. And I'll just briefly, if you don't mind, we had this similar conversation, and we share the same concern. So what I had is I actually met yesterday with Car Equipment Engineering, and we're looking at a car-borne solution where stop means stop. So basically, you would have to take two additional actions to move and stop and proceed. It would take a software solution. It would have to have a hazard analysis done. But essentially, before you can move in a stop and proceed mode, you'd have to toggle the switch back and forth, push a button, and then attempt to proceed. This is in the infancy of conception. But it is something we are looking at, and I agree with you. The other thing I'd like to point out is that running a red signal is not unique to train operators. I'm sure there's tons of people who get red light tickets as drivers or bus operators and this is also not unique to WMATA. Every transit agency in the country or the world is plagued with red signal violations, and it's a human performance issue that needs to get addressed, and it's not a magic bullet that you address all of them in one swoop. It's technology, it's training, it's fatigue. So you have to take a holistic approach to that as well. But I share the same concern as you do.
All right. Let's just keep along this line because in one of your slides, Category 2, you have a reference to action. And the fifth bullet is developing engineering solutions. Is that what you're describing as these engineering solutions?
Yes, and I also like to point out, too, that you can have a red signal violation in ATO as well, because we have certain pocket tracks that if you put an eight-car train in there, you will run the red signal on the other side. So that takes a separate wayside engineering solution as opposed to a call-borne solution. So we're looking at it from a lot of different technology approaches.
Right, well,
and I'm sorry if I'm being a little...
I'm trying to understand okay. What this... engineering this technology fix is,
okay.
Because our current system, most of the trains and most of the lines are not operating under ATO. So what happens under this solution, this engineering fix, when an operator has a red signal and for lack of training or lack of awareness, situational awareness, he puts on the, quote, GANs, or puts on the electricity, as we say, and goes through the red signal. What then happens to discourage him from proceeding further?
The system will allow you to proceed. That was demonstrated in Glenmont. So that's why we're looking for this technology solution where you would have to take three discrete actions in order for you to move and stop and proceed to get propulsion. So, and we are addressing it through training, through route familiarization, through human factors, but this would be a car-borne solution that would have to be developed, has analysis performed, and then implemented.
Okay.
Kathy Hudson.
Hello?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I wanted to go back to the Falls Church incident. And I appreciate all of the detail about the series of folks who look at this issue. But one of the things that I guess the riders look for is, what is my ride like? So when the East Falls Church piece was identified and for trains running through that area, would there have been any change of your ride during that time frame?
We missed the last part.
Could you repeat the last part, Kathy? They just didn't hear that last sentence.
Okay. In that incident where the track split, the interlock was not working properly, is the ride on the train any different? We caused the derailment, obviously. Would not the day before or some other time there have been any suspect of problems?
Generally, and for that type of scenario, you would have a difference in the ride quality going over that area. So potentially somebody could have identified it if it was severe enough.
And so if there was something that anyone would have observed and someone said something, would that have to provoke any investigation in order to begin finding out if there was a problem?
That's a possibility.
And do we, and I guess this is the general manager and the others, when users call in and say that there are problems, how do we categorize those kinds of concerns?
Sure. Basically, anything that comes to our attention, we send it to the operation unit responsible, whether it's bus or rail or metro access, and basically look into whatever that issue is. I get them personally. I know that we get them from station managers, from, you know, across the board. But basically, we follow up immediately. We may not have the answer for the person right away, but we do act as soon as we get that information.
And so if anyone would have called in about any trains running, being taken out, would the drivers, the train operators have reports in? And is there anything special about how they categorize their concerns?
Again, they would have reported it up the chain. I'm not aware of any report of any issues with the ride on that portion of the track.
And this is a July event, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I guess I'll come back to that one later.
Okay. Thank you. Carol?
Yes. Good morning. I'm going back to inspection. I understand after the derailment there were questions about whether inspections made, were they done correctly, et cetera, and you're developing a new system. What process or system will you have in place to assure in the future these inspections are made as they're supposed to be, both the inspectors and the supervisors? How will you track that? And the second part of the question relates to Maximo, the database. The FTA report says that Maximo was not being updated routinely by the inspectors. Consequently, the maintenance managers didn't know the status of the track and couldn't prioritize maintenance properly. Are you addressing that in your new approach?
Okay. Regarding the inspections, I think that's the reason why we're bringing in our internal, and this unit reports directly to Paul, does not report to me, but this unit that will be coming in, not only looking at safe track, but we'll be looking at the when I said work processes, that's part of it. We'll be looking to see that we're performing the inspections on time, are we performing quality inspections, and that's how we like to go moving forward. That other contract that I had is when we talked about the asset conditioning, one of the things we've asked them to do, we're going to give them like a maximal from an empty database. So as they start identifying defects, not only can we use that to drive the capital program, but we will be starting from scratch with a new set of eyes giving us what should be a maximum. I think getting back to your maintenance managers, that's, again, working with them and making sure that we're prioritizing the work, that they have whatever training they need in order to move forward. So I think those are the other issues that we need to look at.
Carol, one of the other things, too, is when you start looking at your inspection process, you start looking at the wording in the inspection processes. So, for example, some of the inspections require a monthly inspection. So therefore, you could do that January 1st or February 28th. You're still in compliance, but you have 58 days elapsed between those two inspections. So what we're looking at is coming up with a matrix where it's truly a 30-day inspection as opposed to monthly. And just to speak to your question about Maximo, we are looking at Maximo, you know, what are the capabilities of the system? Are we, you know, are there things that could be done better? But I think one of the bigger concerns was not necessarily that the defects were not in Maximo, but that as they did consecutive inspections, those defects should have been upgraded. Some say a priority 2 to a priority 1 to a black. I think that was the bigger concern, not necessarily that they weren't there, they weren't being upgraded.
Okay. If I could just add, basically what we have now is three levels. Joe is responsible, and he knows it, to make sure that the work is done. Pat is looking at basically from a safety perspective, and then the quality assurance group, which is a direct report to me, is overseeing everything they do. So it's in effect three levels. Historically, that generally was under operations.
Okay. Also in the FTA report, they said, quote, the single most important action to restore track integrity is to maintain and unclog drains in tunnels. They also suggest that this had not been done routinely. Is that correct? And if so, are we changing that?
No, you're absolutely right. It was actually when I was here prior to coming here August 1st, it was an issue that we had. And it's one area that we're bringing to our forces, both in track as well as in structures, making sure that there is a not only just a priority, but that we get into a more secular cleaning cycle when it comes to making sure that the drains and the pumps are being handled or being maintained properly. So we are looking into that. Yes.
It is. If I could just add, I mean, so it's a combination of management to make sure it's all being done right, all that. But it is also a matter of time because it takes time to get out there and do that work. And that's again, where we've put safety above service, and that's what that means.
In fact, some of the early outs in the evening time on the red line was just for that purpose. It was not only just changing the insulators, but trying to mitigate the water issues that we were having up there. So cleaning drains and getting rid of the muck on the road there.
I have one more quick question. My time is about it. The TKIN and the TKMN management and supervisory teams, according to the FTA, were significantly understaffed. I wonder if you think that's correct, and if so, is that a resource problem?
That's from the track integrity?
This was from their track integrity report, page 32.
Yeah, we'd have to get back to you about that.
Okay, Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, how are you? So I've been on this board almost 5 years, and back around 5 years ago, the board was begged to buy this Mad Max machine called the TCGV. All right, so we all said, okay, $7.8 million to buy this Mad Max machine, and now the NTSB is saying it's out of service. And we last time we talked about this was when the Smithsonian derailment happened, when the operator accidentally deleted the data. The operator quit. Somebody else quit. What's the story with the Mad Max machine?
Okay, the TGV.
Yeah. I'm not an engineer.
Okay. It did run in February of 2016. We did a full system run. It is running today to do the second TGV, the geometry. One of the deficiencies that we found in this incident is that it had not been running through the actual crossovers. It is now doing that today.
Really?
Yes, sir.
So how many crossovers do we have that the Mad Max machine missed?
Well, it would have, I assume, did most of the terminals. It's the intermediate interlockings that would have been missed.
So, and that's been going on since we bought this thing for almost $8 million, like 5 years ago?
Basically, institutionally, it was not being used in the crossovers.
Really? Great. Okay. All right. Last question. Since you all are from New York, now I want to get your opinion. Okay. The board of the MTA in New York has a capital program oversight committee that meets regularly. and they also have outside consultants that report directly to the board. Agree or disagree that this board should consider that?
I think any time.
the board can consider, you know, they can do whatever they choose. If you want to create something like that, you can create whatever you want.
Oh, okay. We're thinking about it. I just want to know whether or not you think it works.
I think it does. I think having an outside set of eyes that are looking in, making sure they do attend some meetings, the progress meetings, so they're looking to see if the schedules that are being produced by the contractor, are real schedules, and making sure that they're, whatever work is being done. I don't think they do as much oversight on the actual work sites, but it's more from a scheduling and a budget process. And I think it does work. They have brought up to the board at times or to executive leadership if they saw that there was a conflict. You know, they felt that the contract or the, would not come in, under budget or would come in on time. So from an oversight perspective, having a second set of eyes is good.
Pat, what do you think? Just turn my mic on, I'm sorry. I agree with Joe. If you have a detailed, I don't believe you should become so reliant on outside consultants that it affects every decision. But if you have high complex issues that are at play, it makes good sense to get an independent analysis of that so you can make an informed decision. So I would agree with that. Okay, last question. I'm concerned that even though we've been told that we need more track time, we're not efficiently using the track time access as well as we can. Can you let us know how much track time is efficiently being utilized? Is it half of what we've got? Is it 75% or what?
Yeah, I don't have a percentage. We can definitely do better on utilization of track time. Even with that, if we could maximize every part of it, I still feel that we do not have enough time. It's been repeatedly cited by the FTA as an issue for us, and it's just a reality of an aging system. And again, there's management side to it, but you have an aging system here. It requires getting in to do the type of work we're doing, which impacts. If we do it during the day, you're shutting down your single tracking. If you have more time to do that non-revenue, you can get that out without impacting customers at a less used time.
Malcolm.
Thank you. And first, I just want to thank Chair Evans for bringing this meeting together, because it's just very troubling, the information that we have. I very much support his effort to bring us here now, because we got to talk about this. And to you three, part of the reason why it's so troubling to me is because almost literally 1 year ago, we had this very same meeting. Three different gentlemen over here. All three of you are new. But we had the same meeting 1 year ago. And we had the same kind of discussion about, we should have done this, we should have done that. So one of the things that is important to me is to know what has been done in the last year. Have the gauge rods, for example, that were an issue a year ago, have they all been accounted for in the system, those that are still in the system? Can you answer that for me?
Sure. I believe that early in the year we had over 300 gauge rods. We are roughly about 140 left. Some of them are new, and I would like to say to the board, gauge rods are something that's used throughout the industry. It's a way of making a temporary fix. Engage. But moving forward, after our goal is after we finish our safe track initiative, the ones that are currently underway, that we will have the original 300, over 300 removed. Does not mean a year from now or 2 years from now we will not have gauge rods, but we are putting in place a criteria to have them removed immediately. We're looking somewhere between 14 and 30 days to have them removed in the future. But gauge rods are something that the industry uses, and I just want to make sure it's our goal on the safe track to get rid of the original 300, but to throughout time, we will definitely probably install some and also remove them.
Okay, thank you. You have, what I also just would like to know, what is the chain, and you talked about it a little bit, Paul, but just for clarification, what is the chain of command from the bottom all the way to you?
If I could, just one other comment. The other day when we shut down the, when we were singing the arch line during the PM peak, historically we would have put the gauge rods in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do it. And we would put it off and gotten to it when we could get to it. And so that's, again, a different way of managing. I'm sorry, in terms of, you know, the team that I'm putting together understands, you know, the way that we're approaching this. We are letting every employee understand that this is the way that we are going forward and that, again, we expect them to be equal participants. But we also expect them, and they will be held accountable. So that goes from, again, every single level. It doesn't stop. Again, it's not a union issue. It is an agency-wide issue that we're addressing.
So along those lines, you've now gone through and you've checked or rechecked some of what was done. Have you gone back and has there been disciplinary action? What has been the disciplinary action over the last year?
We're not finished that.
Over the last year,
we've done a number of things on the disciplinary.
Well, that plus, I'm also just inquiring about that, the disciplinary action that you have learned now that you've gone in and you're looking at these things again and going back and understanding, for me, what the requirements on those different levels, particularly on the supervisory side of things, that they are being measured on, and that has there been, based on what you've seen, you guys went back and you looked and you found some things that you needed to fix. I mean, has that been written up? I mean, is that something that has risen to an action from a management standpoint?
It's currently underway at different levels, both
okay.
From an administrative side and then also from an investigative side.
Okay, thank you. Just know that I think that that's a very important. I'd want to see that is happening, obviously. And then finally, I asked a year ago for a review of our policies and procedures and whether or not they made sense or not, and that if they don't, we change them. If they do, we adhere to them. And if the people have not been adhering to those policies and procedures, again, what have we done from a management standpoint with that?
One of the bigger ones is the Manual 1000, which is the one that they actually use for all the track. It's one of the findings from the FTA. It's literally a thing this thick, and we're basically holding people to something that is just unmanageable almost for them. So we are totally redoing that. We're using the experience, obviously, of these gentlemen to bring into that, and also national experience to revamp that to be much more, just more in tune with what the job requires.
Christian?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the first question I have, Mr. Lehman, it concerns the riding inspections that were done for a period during periods of high heat. I was just unclear whether that was a necessity caused by high heat on the track, meaning it was unsafe for people to walk, or the high ambient temperatures, which made it uncomfortable for people to walk.
No, the riding inspections are done throughout the many different agencies. The idea behind it is you want to keep going back, looking for heat kinks in the rail and stuff like that. It wasn't really because it was just too hot. The idea is you want to be riding back and forth more frequently. A walk, typically, they would maybe walk the outbound track one day, the next day, the inbound track. That's their cycle. What we're looking for in a riding inspection is that they're constantly looping back and forth, and that's once the rail temperature reaches 135 degrees, we automatically institute a medium slow speed of 35 miles an hour on the outside, and then those riding inspections will begin.
Thank you. Appreciate that. The next concern is really the issue that we've all been hitting from various angles is how do we just get to the point where this is not something that we're revisiting at some other future point. It seems that our standards are fairly well in place. We've got multiple levels of redundancy to look at track inspections. which all sounds great, but on some level, it begs the question for me, does every piece recognize its importance in making this a holistic inspection system? So to put a little bit more granularity on that, we've got the TGV, we've got the ultrasonic testing, but do the actual walking inspectors understand their critical role? Those pieces are not to replace what they do, it's to augment what they do, to look at it from a different angle. But sometimes when you have many systems of redundancy and you're thinking about high definition video, which is another great thing to do, but will that further disconnect the people who walk the rail from their responsibility to be able to note the very obvious defects such as the deteriorated rail ties that we saw with East Falls Church? Do we have a plan in place to make sure each step recognizes that it can't just simply expect that the other will pick it up, that we all have a role in making sure our I's are dotted and our T's are crossed?
I mean, again, it's not just the track walkers. This is a track walker, supervisor.
Sure.
This is the entire, that entire part of it. It gets to the larger issue that was raised earlier, is that everyone has to understand that they are all part of the solution. You can't be pushing it off to technology. It's the same thing with automated train control or train operations. You know, we got too dependent on that as well. You cannot do that. It's got to be the combination. You use the technology, but it doesn't supplant, you know, the human, and that they should take the action as they see immediately if there's any issue. And that's what we've got to instill top to bottom in the organization.
So I guess my question is, how are we planning on instilling that? Are we including the humans in the conversation as opposed to just laying out the standards, laying out the technology? Are they included in that conversation?
Exactly. I mean, Joe mentioned, you know, the town halls, but basically we've got to create that whole relationship across the board. It's not just in rail. It's in bus. It's in bus maintenance. It's, you know, across the entire organization. As I mentioned, we haven't tapped into that resource as much as we should, I don't think, as managers. You know, we haven't gotten to the frontline people and made that connection.
Thank you. And, Pat, you talked about red light signals and, you know, it's a fact of life everywhere, even though we do not expect that it should occur. I want to balance that understanding of human failing with the reality that we have just been lucky up until this point, that it hasn't resulted in catastrophic loss of equipment, property, or, of course, injury to human beings. Understanding that this is a condition that everybody faces, not just WMATA and not just on rail, how do you balance that with the fact that this is happening at a higher and more frequent interval that eventually our luck's going to run out?
I'm going to go back and agree with what you said earlier. I believe that the evolution of this organization was too overly reliant on technology. They had gotten to a point where they believed that if we could eliminate human performance and rely so heavily on technology, then we wouldn't have these occurrences where we go into this manual mode of operation and we would rely on ATO as the cure. That, now we're in an environment 40 years later where you're not relying on ATO, you have this human performance element. And my solution to that is you try to, once again, take some type of technology approach to make three discrete actions on the human side of it to prevent this from occurring. But that's the approach I believe would be the most practical and it'd be the most beneficial to implement.
Okay. Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. I have a couple of quick questions about our relationship with FTA as they do their work. First, a broad question. All three reports administered over the last couple of months have suggested good progress has been made, and that's terrific. They also suggest that much of the investigation work is done with WMATA staff and that in real time issues are being raised during the investigation. And of course, there's a pretty long lag between when that work gets done, when a report is issued, and of course we have 30 days to respond to what's in the report. I'm just wondering if we're confident that issues that are raised in real time during that joint investigation work being processed and dealt with even before reports were issued by FDA.
They are dealt with in real time. So what usually occurs is someone from my staff will escort them. If they identify a problem, it's brought to us. We bring in the subject matter expert for that area, and they address it. And then typically 3 or 4 days later, we'll get the written report. But we get the verbal notification in real time, and we address those issues in real time.
Okay, thanks. A more specific question. The track integrity investigation report was issued on August 8th. Were there any surprises? I know we have 30 days to respond to the August 8th report, but was there anything in the report that surprised you all?
I had read the APTA report prior to that, the APTA peer review. They were very similar findings. I don't think I was taken aback by anything I saw in that report.
Well, one thing that was in there was a mention of FDA reporting to us that there were track issues between Vienna and Boston. Was there any specificity in their information that they provided to us that we should have been more tuned into the possibility of an issue at East Falls Church?
I don't believe they mentioned the crossover at East Falls Church specifically, and I think if I recall correctly, and I'd have to verify this, they directed us to the underground portion of Boston, and it was in the context of drainage as well as track issues. So the area that I think they wanted us to focus most heavily on was the underground section of that area at Boston.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Listening to the presentations, the main takeaway I came away with was that in general, generally, we've got the policies and the procedures that we should have. It's just that we are not adhering to those. We're not doing the things that we know that we should be doing. And I'm, as one of the longer-term board members, I remember when I came on the board in early 2011, the board was, and the management was very focused on recovering from the crash, the 2009 crash at Fort Totten. And at that point, like right now, there was a big emphasis on safety, a big push on safety. What do we need to do? What procedures do we need to do? How do we get people, you know, to adhere to those procedures? And in the time since then, I think, and I don't think it's just WMATA, I think it's institutions in general. As time goes by, people get more lax. It's probably a human thing. We're unable to continually focus with laser precision on something over a long period of time. And so I guess my question, and this is probably to Paul as well as to anybody else, you're an experienced manager. As an experienced manager, how does one deal with this problem that you can put a focus on safety and you can do all the right things, you can put all the right procedures in place, you can train the people, you can and emphasize to them that it is important to do. But over time, human beings tend to lose that focus. So, and I'd be interested in hearing from anyone, but certainly from you, what do you do to prevent this slippage over time?
Right. I think you welcome third-party reviews. You know, you don't shy away from them. You seek them out. So whether it's FDA, whether it's the new Safety Commission, you know, that you are establishing, whether it's us bringing in contractors, whether it's us, in effect, also just doing management, you know, initiatives on our own that forces us to go back and revisit what had become now standard practice and to rethink it. So I think it's being proactive about those things and not just sort of saying, okay, we took care of that, now let's just sort of go on forward.
Does anyone else have anything to add from your specific areas of expertise?
I think a lot of this has to do with compliance and changing the culture here. I think Paul and I have had conversations in the past, Pat will know, coming from New York, where we tried to preach to our employees and all our employees from, you know, entry level all the way up through executive level. The people on our trains, the people on our buses, they should be your family. That's how you should look at it. And as we approach our work every single day, that's what we should be thinking about. That those are family members that are on our system. We they have a contract with them when they swipe in to get them home safely. And I'm hoping that in the next few months, the next few years, we can start to turn that culture and make sure people are looking, as they come to work every day, towards that that goal and model. That, you know, if you can't have your family ride our system, then, you know, maybe you shouldn't be working here.
I'd like to just add one other thing. If you look at organizations that have high-performing safety cultures, most of those individuals had some time in the safety department. So if you took New York City Transit as a model, Tom Pendergrass, who was the chairman of the MTA, it was at one time the president of New York City Transit, he started the system safety department in New York. Carmen Bianco ran the system safety department in New York, went on to be president. Joe Leader was the director of investigations in New York. He went on to be senior vice president. Myself, I spent 20 years in operations and the last 13 years in safety. So to have an effective safety department, you need that cross-pollination of operations and safety, and that's how you get to a high-performing state of safety.
Thank you.
Paul?
Thank you, Jack, and I apologize to everyone for not being able to be there in person. Mr. Wiedenfeld and others, I really appreciate the fact that you're acknowledging that, in the past anyway, that there's been a real sort of disconnect between management and employees at some really important times and important programs, and the fact that you're addressing that, I really appreciate that. But I do want to ask about communication in general. This is an area that keeps coming up time and time again from an operational internal perspective and also from, you know, a hardware, software perspective. Mr. Loudon, I believe you mentioned in your presentation that we are deficient in that area. You had a slide on it. So I guess my question is very plainly, how deficient are we in the communications area and how concerned are you about it?
Sorry, the question was communications?
Yes.
Generally, how do you feel?
We're deficient in that area, so how deficient are we?
When you say communication, can you give me a context? Do you mean between management and union or communication system-wide, or I'm just looking for the context.
All the above, really.
Well,
it's an area that keeps coming up time and time again.
Well, I can tell you based on my past experience in New York, and Roger Toussaint, who happens to be the former TW head, happens to be here. We've had some pretty horrific accidents in New York as well. Some of them involved employee fatalities. We had a very good working relationship with the union. We would put a union member on our board of inquiry so that, you know, we wanted them to have a role in it. That's something that maybe we can improve here with safety committees, having more union participation and putting out that olive branch to improve communication. It's something I've done in the past. I'm not opposed to doing it, you know, here at WMATA. I actually went out to Maryland, you know, to meet Jackie Jeter. I went out to the union headquarters so that we would have a face-to-face dialogue. So I don't see it as an obstacle here as far as improving union management relationships.
And what about from a equipment perspective and a software perspective? Do we have the type of equipment we need for an efficient communication system between, you know, our operations center and the trains and you know, the localities and emergency personnel in the various jurisdictions?
Yeah, I believe there's a global project to improve radio communication system-wide. In the interim, I know we've funded projects in individual yards to improve communications, add additional cell towers. We monitor the locations where radio communications are a problem. We address them rapidly. So we are working on the communication piece, and we recognize that's an area that we can improve in.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Bob?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. A few questions, and a lot of good discussion here today, I must say. But one of the concerns that I have is, as we seem to have different events, whether they're accidents or incidents, that generate a look into some of the policies and procedures of Washington Metro, and then we're surprised that
that they're not followed. And my concern is, yes, we're looking very closely at track, and we found that many of the inspections were not followed. Was that surprising to you, Mr. Lyman?
I don't know if surprising is the right word, because I've done investigations in the past where we've had similar failings for a variety of reasons. I think one of the historic problems here is the lack of track time, where people weren't given the opportunity to do work, and they've kind of gotten out of that mode of operation. I think with Safe Track and a lot of the initiatives that the GM has put forward, we're correcting that.
Well, one of the concerns that I have is if we have these problems with track, where we have inspection procedures that are not being followed and not being followed up on, we have the same problem with our signal inspections, our rolling stock inspections, the other safety critical, or do we get to an accident and have an incident and look and say, oh my God, you know, we're not doing what we're supposed to. Are you guys looking at that, those other systems to make sure that we are doing those inspections for the standards?
Most of the questions that we've been asked today, we've asked internally, and that being one of them. And one of the things we are doing is there's an independent quality assurance group. We want to expand the role of that group to start doing exactly what you're asking. Because I don't want to treat this as this could just be an isolated track problem. We have to look at signals, power, transportation, car equipment, vehicles, bus maintenance. This is an organizational problem that we need to address.
And I just to add, I mean, a number of those are underway. You know, several months ago, we were focusing all on power. Well, that's still going on. You know, right now the focus has turned, public focus and the board's focus, rightly, has turned towards the track issue. But, you know, we're doing the same initiatives on the power side. We're doing bus maintenance, a number of initiatives on all those fronts. So it's not just all of a sudden we're running the track. Those continue as well.
Well, good. That's encouraging. One of your slides you had up there, you talked about the derailment in East Falls Church, and you had several bullets. One was failure to monitor, failure to inspect, and defects were incorrectly classified. And I look at a lot of the responses to that, and it seems to go training, training, training. Is there a feeling that the track inspectors don't have the information they need to properly inspect the Washington Metro track?
I think it depends on which track inspector you go to. There's a lot of newer inspectors who might not have had institutional knowledge prior to becoming track inspectors, which could be one problematic area. And I don't think you could just narrow it down to training, so I agree with you. I mean, a lot of this speaks to a lack of oversight and supervision at that next level to go out and verify that the defects that were in the defect databases were appropriately classified and had those defects escalated, that they were then again upgraded to a more serious category, which would invoke either a speed restriction or a cessation in service.
But certainly the managers know and are well trained and know what the standards are and can make sure that those track inspectors follow this, right?
No, yes, they are. I think the big thing we have to look at, too, is, well, one of the things I will be looking at is, are my managers self-auditing themselves? And I think that's it. I should, although I would like an external group to come in now and look at track and look at all these other areas. What I would like to know is, what are my managers doing? Okay, and they should be setting up throughout the year and be thinking about things. You know, which areas should I look into? What rock do I uncover? And that's some of the practices I would like to bring here, because I don't think they're doing it right now.
Okay, and with my last 30 seconds here, I just wanted to say that I'm very happy to know that you're inspecting these crossovers, but one thing I was surprised is that some of these issues weren't identified before, because with a system safety approach, when you're doing major programs like SafeTrack and you're changing operations, now these crossovers that are used occasionally when you have a problem, now every single train is going through these same crossovers. I would expect with SafeTrack, when you have these programs and you start it up, that you do a hazard analysis and look at the potential problems that may come up. So with that, I'm out of time. I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. We've finished our first round of questioning, so we will go now to our second round. We've covered a lot of ground, and if you don't feel you have to use your second round, but if you have follow-up questions or you think an area that we have not covered, this is a good opportunity to do that. So I'll start with myself. Chief, we don't want you to feel left out. So I want to ask you a question, and this is serious. You know, I'm sitting at home, and I either get called or read this idea that one of our officers has had contacts with ISIS, and we've been following this officer for 4 years. And so the concerns start that I have and that the public has is, what do you mean we've been following this person for 4 years? Have we followed him 24/7 for 4 years? Was he out of our sight? Was he in a position that he could have done destructive things? Why did we arrest him when we did? So there are a million questions, and it happened like a month ago, but it seems like an eternity ago and has almost been forgotten. So I want you to tell me, as you know, to answer those questions. I mean, what happened here to the extent that you can tell us?
Yes, certainly. So Mr. Young started displaying behavior that was just abnormal, or you might find concerning, you know, me as a police chief or a deputy chief, wherever I was at the time, that raised us some concerns. So at that point in time, we contacted our local FBI field office, made them aware of these observations, and they started doing various means of surveillance, whether technology solutions or physical, whatever the case may be. At some point in time, he reached out to what he believed to be an ISIL sympathizer, supporter. In fact, he was contacting a local law enforcement officer. So those conversations began physically or verbally, as electronically, various means over the course of time. And over that course of that investigative period, he started taking actions that were overt to the government, et cetera, and subsequently was arrested. The FBI and our partnership had means in place that if, again, he posed an immediate risk to any of our employees or our riders, that actions would have been taken swiftly. Unfortunately, investigations of this magnitude take a long period of time. There's all kinds of, you know, rules and laws we have to adhere to. So it never goes as quick as we like, but we're happy that it ended the way it did.
Okay. What are the chances there are others out there like this? Do we have any ideas?
I think as you may have heard, you know, throughout the law enforcement community, you know, homegrown violent extremists are our biggest threat right now. When you look at the homegrown terrorist type people, there's no warning signs, there's no precursors. So I think the threat of homegrown extremes are always out there. Are there any internal to the Metro Transit Police now? No, I'm not aware of any, nor is the FBI.
Okay. For all three of yourselves, on July 30th, I had an opportunity to listen to and speak to several thousand of our employees at a church over on Capitol Hill. It's a hot Saturday. We were there from 12 to almost 3 o'clock, and I want to recognize we have a number of employees who are here today, members of the union. I want to thank you for coming out as well. There were two themes at the end of the day, and our employees got up and spoke to me and others about their experiences here. The two themes were, no one listens to us. We know the system better than anybody. We know where the flaws are. We know where the breakdowns are, and nobody seems to listen to us. We don't know how to communicate to the management what the problems are. And secondly, no one really appreciates the work we do. We work hard out there every day. We clean the cars. We do fix the tracks. We do all this stuff, and nobody seems to really appreciate what we do. So, Paul and the rest of your management staff there, we're all new here. So, tell me what your thoughts are on that. How do we help? How do we get our staff to be, our employees to be listened to disseminate the information they know, and how do we show them that we appreciate what they do every day?
Now, I agree with both of those points, and it's something that you know, I've been personally involved with. I mean, we've done things as simple as literally we've asked station managers to give me ideas of things that we could knock out in 30 days. You know, give me some short, simple wins that they reflect that we hear you. It's everything from restrooms to break rooms to all kinds of issues, but also to our customer issues. So we'd have to continue as a management team to do that. We have to reach out. We've done town halls and to listen to do that, but there's not enough. We need to do much more of that, and we have to tap into that resource because they do know, and we have to, you know, recognize that. And we haven't, again, just as an organization over years, that just hasn't been a focus. And it is a focus of mine.
And, you know, I've spoken personally to thousands of our employees, and the two things we talk about is, one, what can I do for you? And the other is, what you can do for me is take pride in your job. If you take pride in your job, then guess what? Everything starts to fall into place. And that's a constant message I have individually with every employee I meet.
Okay. Thank you. Keturah?
Thank you, Jack. Just to dovetail a little bit on what you were asking, in the first round, there seemed to be a lot of emphasis on accountability and getting that down, not just from a group level, but to an individual level. And I'm just curious, you mentioned certain statements that, you know, this is not a union issue, this is an agency issue. Can you elaborate a little bit on whether or not some of the safety breakdowns, the communication breakdowns, how much of that is not just the institutionalization of certain practices, but the institutionalization of certain working rules that we have in general, who we communicate with, who we talk to, and whether certain things, even though on paper are not off banned from communicating with a certain person, but just because this is the way we've always done it, this is our employee silo, this is our management silo, and whether or not, you know, there's a bridge that's being built between the two, and whether or not, you know, we're actually hampering safety by having silos.
No, we definitely are by having the silos, and that's what we have to break down. Again, it's not a management union issue. Again, we have to come at this as an overall team. There are work rules that we have to live by on both sides, and they're literally in contract that we have, labor contracts, as you know, with your background. In the negotiations that we have, we put forward work rule changes as well as the union. So we'll continue to do that. We're in the middle of that process right now, the current round of that. But I really think it's all of us working, understanding why we're here. You know, as Joe talked about, as we literally have met with thousands of employees with that same message, which is, look, you're here to make sure that everyone that comes home safely, meaning you, your fellow workers, and the customers. And, you know, we have to get them, everyone, to think at that level. And then I think that then that just starts to go throughout the entire organization.
And over the process of time, for instance, let's say we've been doing work for a particular type of way for 15 years. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how both sides can, once issues are seen, for instance, mm-hmm. we're not relying on technology anymore. We're now relying on the human, you know, mind and mm-hmm. Their capacity. Is there an appetite for re-looking at certain things that no longer apply or should apply? Because as we advance both technologically and infrastructure-wise, there's a need to address this, modify it, and build a new fundamental agreement that sees safety as the foundation.
I think, that is taking root. I get, literally probably half a dozen or so comments from my employees a day, and it's because now they see that people are listening and we're reacting, and that's across the board. And so I think, again, I think that's the movement. What I've heard when we shut down for the snow, when we shut down for the safety issues, what I heard from the frontline employees, okay, finally people are starting to get serious about dealing with these issues. They're listening, they're understanding, starting to understand our concerns. We're not there by any means, but I definitely feel that across the board, management and frontline employees appreciate that that is where we're headed, and that, you know, that they're on board for it. 100%, probably not, but the vast majority of the employees are at that stage.
Jim?
Thank you. Well, the majority of track inspectors have less than 2 years' experience. How do you become a track inspector? What is the progression to get there?
Normally, it is a minimum requirement of 1 year as a track worker. And that's standard. I think years past when I first came into New York City Transit, that still is the standard, 1 year as a track worker. However, That was a seniority job many years ago. If you didn't have 15 or 16 years on the job, you didn't get it. And I think the workforce has changed a little. And what you see now is through attrition and either promotions or people leaving because of retirements, you've seen that go down. But once you have that 1 year and then you pick into that job, there's a training program that you go through. I believe it's 18 weeks.
Yeah, I'm just going to correct one thing Joe was saying. I think because they had difficulty fulfilling those jobs, I think they relaxed that one-year standard. And they might have been bringing people, and I think, I don't know if Joe saw it yet, but there was an after report that I think cited that, that said they were bringing people in off the street, and with that they were giving them 18 months of training. So some of them may, you know, have to get acclimated to the job and the training. So that's one of the challenges that I think the industry is facing, is getting qualified people for those roles.
So not just WMATA, but across the board.
Yes.
But the standard is normally typically 1 year as a track worker or a track repairman, whatever it is, depending on the, you know, which agency you're in. There's different titles. And that would allow you to be eligible to go into a track inspector's position.
Okay. And going back to that NAFTA report, I think that came out, was it April, somewhere around there? That questioned us on our track inspections that we had to improve that process. What was done after that report? There was a, I believe it was an NAFTA self-examination report that said we had to step up our track inspections, identified some of the things. What results were taken with that, Paul?
I believe that's what resulted in the University of Tennessee being brought on board to get the 2 weeks of training to improve that area.
Okay.
And I believe that also led to the Mount McDonald condition survey, but I'd have to check the timing for that. And that's where we're doing the asset survey of the entire system. There may have been other things that stem from that, but I'd have to look at the timing of whether it came before or after that report.
Okay.
What it did, it started the procurement process for a number of those things. Because it takes some time to
okay.
I think the other piece that came out of it was redoing our manual. I think when the after peer review representative saw our manual, how in some cases detailed it was, they thought for the inspection should be broken out into different categories, a maintenance and an inspection side. So that's what this procurement is going to do, is bring somebody on board to begin looking at that and revamping our manual.
Okay. And I like how it's been mentioned a couple of times that this is not a technology issue, it's not a human issue, it's every way to improve out there. Today, I guess, what kind of technology are we using to help the human factor recognize potential issues, but reporting on those issues that were identified? So, for instance, today, voice recognized technology is being used to get a finding from that inspector to his supervisor to a control place that this needs to be taken care of immediately. It could be voice recognized. It could be GPS recognized, so they know where they're at. They don't have to depend even on the inspector to say, hey, I'm at mile marker 52.1. What technology are we using today to supplement and the human factor, and what technology will we look to use?
I could give you two answers to that question. The first one is, I think one of the things that came out of the TGV from Smithsonian is I believe there was a delay in reporting. So I think they corrected that where they get real-time data, so if there's a defect, they identify rapidly and there's a chase train that addresses those. So that's one area. One of the things that I would like to look at here, and I can tell you we did this in New York, is we looked at employees' lost time accidents. And we have an aging workforce, and a lot of them were getting repetitive injuries from lifting rail. So we went into a mode where we brought in these devices, which were called TRT. The nickname or the acronym was Critters, and they essentially lift the rail for you. They put them in place. So I would like to try to mechanize a lot more of what we're doing or look at what we're doing and see if we can achieve mechanization from a standpoint of reducing employee injuries. I don't know if I'm giving you the answer you're looking for, but that's the...
It was more along the lines of identifying a problem. Like, how quickly, Paul, you mentioned the orange line shut down when there was a fastener recognized there that wasn't in place. Somebody shut the system down. How long, how many trains passed over that once that was recognized? And how would voice-enabled or GPS-enabled technology say this needs to be done immediately?
Well, I think one of the things that we will be looking into is how to, from an inspector's perspective, is if we could eventually get them to go to tablets and where they, not when they're walking their section, they would all have at their ready a database of what they've already reported, which is important because what you want to know is what was previously reported in an area, has that condition worsened? Okay, it may have been written up, but now they go from 15 times to 20 times, and that's what you want to know. So having that backup is very important. With Maximal, it's a great system. That's really the next piece that we need to bring in is probably handhelds. Regarding the video inspections, what's important about that is when an inspector goes home, they take their mind with them. We don't have that resource or that database. So having that video, as backup to go back to is extremely important. And in that technology, there is software recognition. So it can tell you, there was a defect there last month. Is it gone? Is it still there? Or depending on how often your track changes, you can start looking at it where it could actually pick up what's missing. So the industry is moving towards that. The heavy freight is definitely there when it comes to video technology. You're seeing some of the smaller agencies now, the rapid transit systems, going to that video type technology. And what's great about that is if you've got a car that's running and you can identify a defect, if they have a handheld or a device, you can get them that message right away. Hey, at marker 55+00, we got an issue. And have somebody respond more quickly than waiting for them to either call in, get them on a radio, and stuff like that.
So we are moving toward that, or hopefully moving toward that? Okay. Sorry for my overrun.
Not a problem. David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, just one quick follow-up. I know that you talked about Mr. Young and how the FBI and your team sort of tracked him at the course of the investigation. But there's one comment that you made which I have some questions about, which is that Mr. Young was a consistently low performer, not enough to the level of being terminated, but he was a low performer. My question is, you describe the onboarding process being comparable to what they use in Maryland in terms of how you bring officers in and the background check. What is the process for ongoing review of officers? And I know the ISIL fact pattern isn't extreme, but in terms of making sure officers are healthy, that they have that they are mentally balanced, that they're still and their skills are up. What does your organization do for long term to make sure that officers are maintaining their skills and frankly are fit to continue to serve in duty?
Yeah, so we're required, again, because of the compact and the language therein, to meet or exceed the standards. So on an annual basis, we have to go through requalifying with our service weapons every year, and we also have to have at least 20 hours of continuing education, as well as meeting any state mandates. So, for example, the state of Maryland makes a this year, we want every officer recertified in CPR. We want every officer recertified with sex crimes. So each year, whether it's the DCJS out of Virginia or out of Maryland, NPC-TC, they set down state mandates that we must meet or exceed each year. So we go to an annual refresher training with our firearms, classroom time, and then practical time. And then as far as evaluations, our officers are evaluated every year on their performance. 90 days before their performance evaluation is due, they have a sit-down with their supervisor, go over their areas of strengths and weaknesses. And then if that performance doesn't improve by the end of the annual cycle, then they're put on a performance improvement plan.
Thank you, Chief.
Link.
Thank you. I'll admit I was a little surprised to learn from the track integrity report that we perform nearly all of our track inspections just between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on weekdays. Given the extent of the maintenance needs and the need, as you described, to lay eyes on more of the track more frequently, is that the optimal allocation of our time, just between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on weekdays?
Sure, it was driven by safety needs, but I've asked Joe to take entire process. Not only currently how we're doing it, but other times of the day. Changes, obviously, whether you're above ground, below ground, nighttime, daytime, all those types of factors, seasonal. I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it. But the window of time that they're doing that is because of the safety and the demand of basically peak hour service that's doing that. But I have asked for a review of that entire process.
It's my understanding that at least at L.A. Metro, they perform inspections overnight.
In New York, the practice was outdoors, was during the daytime, and in the subway, it was performed at night. And it's something we're looking at. You have lines of services here. We have three lines that are actually running. So how much time, we used to call it wrench time, how much time do you really have on a track before you're clearing up? So those are the issues that we'll be looking at in the future.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I think is important to note is that, you know, we have a lot of the same information. You know, so this most recent investigation by the FTA, you know, it's bringing to light things that we've already, you know, known about. And it seems to me that we have an issue with bringing items to closure. So the SMI report, the items that are related to track integrity, the most common update for those items is WMATA submitted for closure, FTA requesting additional action. And that comes up time and time again. Why can't we close out these items from the FTA?
I don't want to speak for every single CAP, but from my understanding is, I think a lot of the items, and if we're talking about the track integrity report, where they had grouped a lot of the items that were not what we would consider high priority defects, like a priority one, they had done other defects that they identified, and those were given lower priority. So when we went out and addressed them, they would get addressed as a group. So let's assume there was 15 defects in one area. When we went out to that area and closed out that defect, they would come back and say, well, give us documentation for each one of those 15 individual defects, and that's not necessarily the way that we track it. So then I know that my staff and staff from track had met with them so that they could close out these items and have, but the FDA, which they should be doing for due diligence, wanted some kind of verification that they were actually closed. So it was more of an issue between the way we track information and the way that they wanted it presented.
Okay. So with my remaining time, I wanted to just focus on the red light, the red signal violation. Many transit and commuter rail properties require employees to go through specialized training to familiarize themselves with the territory that they're going to be working on. If you look at all the reports that we have with the red light signal running, a common cause or explanation is that the operator doesn't have familiarity with the yard area or the track segment that they're on. What is done before an operator begins a service on a line to familiarize them with that track? And how does that compare to what other systems do to get their operators prepared to safely operate their equipment?
I believe they are now doing route familiarization, and in addition to that, they're using the video from the TGV car, and the TGV car now on the front of it has video that captures the right-of-way. So what they do is that's part of the initial training, and then if there's a pick where someone transfers from, say, the green line to the orange line, they now have to get a refresher on that line as well. So I believe that that is being addressed.
Okay. Michael?
Thank you. Gentlemen, I have one more follow-up question on the red light running phenomena before turning to the East Falls Church derailment. I just want to pick up on Mr. Bulger's theme of do they do it better in the Big Apple. So the question on the red light running is that is there something New York subways do operationally or in terms of equipment that reduces the incidence of red light running that we don't do here?
It does not reduce it because I believe there was a very high number of red signal runs in New York last year. The difference is that New York has what's called a fixed block signal system, which means it's a segment of track, and on that track there's a stop arm that engages a trip talk on a train. So So if you go past that signal, it places you in emergency. And it does, it'll emergency brake the train and stop it in its tracks. Their frequency of red signal overruns is much greater than the frequency that you're experiencing here at WMATA. The issue here is WMATA is that the consequence could be much greater because of this ability to travel at 12 miles an hour and essentially rely on the actions of the train operator. So I wouldn't tie them to frequency. I would look at consequence.
I mean, one thing I was thinking about was that I know when I've ridden the New York subway, on each train there seems to be a second employee who sort of looks at and manages the crowding in the station and the loading of the cars so that the train operator, you know, can focus on red lights and where he's going. I take it that's not something that you would recommend for this system?
In New York, we also have lines with just single train operators, but those are on less heavily congested lines. And, I mean, I don't necessarily see a great benefit for that here. I mean, any time you add a second person, theoretically, you can get benefit, but I don't know if it derives that great of a benefit.
All right. Turning to the East Falls derailment, as Mr. Augustine pointed out, and Mr. Plumager pointed out, we've been here before from the Smithsonian incident last year, sort of like Groundhog Day. In that incident, you guys weren't here, but what happened was that the TGV vehicle went through, found the wide gauge condition, misread by the TGV operator. For 30 days, the track inspectors missed the same wide gauge, and 30 days later, train ran off the track. But even before then, we have the FTA's safety management oversight report, which pointed out the same problem with track inspectors and problems of that nature. And one of their recommendations was that we should have more inspectors. And the reason they made that recommendation is because historically we had two inspectors, two sets of eyes who would go down the track, one guy on track one, one guy on track two, but then we changed the practice so we only have one set of eyes, and the other guy in the two-man team became a railway safety officer. So we had half the number of eyes going down the track. So my question to you is, are we looking at that FTA recommendation, and why not? Why shouldn't we increase the total number of inspectors from the current 59 so we have two sets of eyes when these guys go down the track?
It's one area that I will be looking at, but I can tell you in other agencies, they don't even use two track inspectors together. They will have what you would call here a RIC, who would be the watch person for a track inspector, one track inspector walking. I'll give you an example. We have a process in New York where the union at a very high executive level will meet with the president, and it's overseen by a representative from DOT. And we talked about this issue, and his job at DOT at one time, he was over the highway department, and he saw a rash of accidents during a snowplow in upstate New York, and they thought putting two people in the cab, one driving and one to keep the other person awake or one asleep, would be the solution to the problem. And they found out they had more accidents when they put the second person in there. I think the standard you have here with two track inspectors we can look at. I don't think adding more track inspectors is needed right now in the process. I think if, you know, again, go back to the training and the compliance, if we follow the rules, I think we're a safe system.
Okay. One more question. I'm reading to you from an article in the Washington Post, one around August 2nd, 3rd, or 4th, and quote, NTSB investigators also contend that Metro officials may have known about the problems with the tracks, referring to the degradation of the ties, in that area since 2009. I realize none of you were here, as was I in 2009, but I'm sure you're aware of that report and that allegation. Two questions. Is it true? And if it is, was there such a person? And did he make a record of that deterioration in 2009? Or is there some record that you found in the WMATA system suggesting, reporting that there has been that condition since 2009?
I'll have to check the date, but I believe it was said in a context that
there was a record. It could have been 2009, and I believe that goes back to the defect being classified as a T2 defect. So there was a record of a defect in the area, and what I had mentioned in my PowerPoint is that that defect was never upgraded to reflect that it had deteriorated to either a priority one or a black defect, which would have called for that track to be out of service. So there could have been a recorded defect in the database, but it was misclassified as a P2.
And whose responsibility was it to upgrade that defect so that it became known to people up the chain of command, including the general manager and the chief operating officer?
That's the function of the track walker, to go out and identify that the defect during their weekly inspections has deteriorated and to upgrade it. It's also the function of the supervisor to go out and field verify defects. It's also the function of the manager to ensure that inspections are occurring at the required frequency, and it's all of our responsibility to make sure that we're protecting the riding public. So we all share responsibility in that.
Okay. Kathy?
I just kind of want to follow on to that one. As I asked before, I asked about what other information you might have prior to the derailment. And I was trying to recall the experience that I had and the actions that were taken. And was there any relationship? Because in the preliminary findings, it was an easy find there that there was nothing from the operator, there was nothing from the rock. All those things seemingly worked. This derailment occurred, it seems to be within a time frame just prior, in which we had an offload on Silver Line, and the train was about to run off the track, it felt like. And the train operator actually offloaded us. And the same time that I was calling WMATA staff. And so what was interesting to me here was for this kind of derailment to occur, would there not have been some prior operations that may have signaled that? And you seem to have referenced that just prior to the prior discussion, that if something was missed, this would have occurred. And it's sort of like the canary in the mine. When you get to a point of a derailment, are there not built up other operational aspects that we should all know about so that it's not the canary? And the canary are your passengers and the train operator, and to me, anybody else that comes in back. How do we stand by? I'm looking at slide 18, and I've gone through them quite a bit since the presentation was sent out, because that's what occurred. We were all on this train, and it was about to just sort of shaking, and you could barely sit in the seat. And finally, the operator says, we're going to hold this train. And a couple of weeks later, we hear about the derailment. So, to me, I am appreciative of the information that we're given that helps us look at the highest level and say who's doing their job. But it's also at that lowest level that we need to be able to rely upon the role that those folks play in order to know what you're going to do at that highest level. And that's the question I have here. I asked before, were there reports, and your preliminary said that there seems to have been nothing, no operator concerns, no lock concerns. Is that consistent?
I'm not aware of any operator concern prior to that, but I can certainly look into that aspect of it. But I don't believe that any person notified us prior to the derailment of a concern in that area.
I just know that the operator of the train did announce the offload and taking the train out of service, and it was just as we got before we got to the South Church station. And so I just left that one as an unclear piece to me.
So we'll take a look at the offload records to see if there's anything that ties to that.
Okay. All right, Carol.
Thank you. I have one quick follow-up for Mr. Leader. You mentioned, I think, 110 sharp curves, which are very vulnerable sections, and you're doing an inspection of those. first, how far along is the inspection? Have you turned up anything disturbing in the inspection? And when do you expect it will be complete?
We started it this past Monday. And as far as I know right now, they have not come up with anything. And we should have it completed by the end of the month.
Tom?
A little over a year ago, WMATA staff told the D.C. staff that we would be modifying the ATO software so the six car trains could operate on the red line and that we would be under automatic train operation for eight car trains on the red line. The FTA was one indicate that this has not happened. Can you tell us the status of upgrading the ATO software to allow six car trains to operate in automatic mode on the red line?
I'm of the belief there's supposed to be a presentation in either September or October on that and return to ATO.
So we are ATO.
We are on ATO for eight car trains on the red line?
I believe there's only eight car trains on the red line.
Okay, so you let us know if the software patch or whatever can work on six car trains?
I'll have to get back to you.
Would you
think it was a little more complex than that? I think it was station by station with some type of device in the middle of the station, so you equally divided the train, so it's
right.
Not the center of the platform.
Right.
So yeah, I think you'd have to check each platform. I think it was a little more complex than that, but I'll try to get to
it. Well, it's also related to safety, too, about red lights and automatic versus manual versus the 12-mile, whatever you guys call that.
Stopping procedure.
Yeah. So let us know about the automatic train control.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Malcolm?
Thank you. Just to follow up, the thing that that really bothered me last year was that in the safety organization, it was much more reactive than it was proactive. Can you, and you've shared some of the things, Mr. Lavin, about being more proactive than reactive. Can you share, as you pull in your investigators, how will they have a dual function of that includes some proactive action, some inspection, and things like that, in addition to investigating incidents after they've occurred?
Sure. I'd like to just briefly tell you a story. When I got here, we had gotten a complaint about someone getting jostled on a train, and I didn't know if it was the train operator, the signal system, or whether it was a call point problem. So when we looked into it, it turned out it was a bobbing track circuit. So I spent a lot of focus on bobbing track circuits, and the reason why is because I spent 20 years in signals, so it was kind of a pet peeve of mine. So we, in the last 3 months, have got bobbing track circuits from somewhere over 300 to around 83, because we've given that more of a focus. So there's a lot of things that we are doing that don't necessarily get talked about in this meeting, but we are taking a proactive approach to safety, and we are looking at different areas.
Okay, thank you. That's very important to me, and it is important, I think, that we know, I mean, as disappointed as I am here, I mean, and I am, though, that you are taking proactive efforts, and I know that you are, but that you're also doing some things, and I hope that you would look back at this last year and what some of your predecessors did and actually not do that. I mean, since it doesn't seem to have actually brought us forward, as it were, because we're hearing the exact same problems and same issues. And so I hope that this definitely will review that. And I just want to just go back, just for clarity for me, You said that you understood about the gauge rods and all of those that you have, the 300 or so. First of all, was there any gauge rods in this incident area? Were there any in there?
There were not any gauge rods in the immediate area that the train traversed. There were gauge rods in the surrounding area, but not where the train actually derailed.
Okay. And were all of those gauge rods in the, for lack of a better word, kind of like census of the gauge rods that you Pat?
That gauge rod was documented on the inspection form.
Okay. And so, and within the system as a whole, you have those gauge rods that are helping to support the, obviously, the system. Are there also others, perhaps, that over the life of this system are also out in the system, maybe that are degrading and things like that, that you are aware of?
I would say that's one of the priorities that we put on it. I think when Pat first got here and I first got here, I didn't feel that the gauge rods were getting the attention. And this goes back to my period of time when I was doing some consulting work here for Washington Metro. And we've now made that a priority towards it. So when we first were looking at it, that was the first thing we looked at. Are they still intact? Once we made sure they were still intact now, are we scheduling the work to get done? And that's why we went from 300. We're still over 100, but a lot of those, the 149 or so that are still on the books, some of them are new, recently just installed.
Okay, but you're saying that there's no old ones that are out there just sort of in the system, perhaps not, again, not, you know, you feel like you've got a map that covers the entire system and we know where they all are. Thank you.
Christian?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll hope to be brief. So this has been an extremely illuminating conversation. Thank you. And I think it's been helpful not only to us but to the public. But you know, I want to take away from the specific knowledge that we've all gained today and function on our role as board members. And, you know, we ultimately have to trust that you're going to implement the plan, that you're going to utilize the knowledge that you've displayed for functional efforts. We provide you with the resources. We've replaced top leadership, who has in turn replaced associated leadership. My question to any of you is, what can we as a board do to ensure that the results that we, I think, all clearly want are achieved? What's our role in implementing your plan?
I mean, obviously, your role is at the policy level. We have to make some.
But the policies are good, right? We're acknowledging.
No. I'm not talking about manuals.
Okay.
I'm talking about overall policy decisions that need to be made that I will bring to the board that you will need to consider. There's obviously a financial part of this that you know has been talked about. That's part of the budgeting process that we're coming up upon. So that's clearly another big part for the board to play. I think reinforcing the value of all of our employees and what they do both in the community and what they do for service, I think is important for the board to do as well as for the management team to do that, to recognize what they do. So I think, you know, again, playing the role of a board, which is the oversight role, and providing the support for the staff that is working on this, understanding it. But then we're going to use the overall, you know, the resources to perform. To what level do you want to perform based on those resources?
I mean, to whatever extent we can, I think it's important for us both collectively and working with you to really think about that, how we can do things differently, because as has been mentioned before, this is not the first time that we've been down this rodeo, and we want to continue to do things the same or have the same expectations because we're likely to meet with similar results. And then the second question is about the needed change of culture, and it's really been hard to pinpoint, and that worries me because things that are hard to pinpoint are difficult to implement and to actually change. So we kind of know that the culture needs to be changed, that employees need to be both accountable but also valued. And I'm not asking for an answer now, but over the course of the coming months, I think it would be really important to see what we are specifically going to employ that we think is going to lead us to a different result. Because culture changes can be generational, and we don't really have generational time to see that our culture changes. So that's just more of a comment for us to think about moving forward.
Tony?
No question, but a request. Whether it's a WMATA-initiated review, like an APTA review or an oversight report, and even before I make the request, I know there's balance that has to be struck. If the board can get information on ongoing reports before they're in final, that would be pretty helpful. Because in the end, reading it after it's already been cranked out Lee just asked lots of questions about what happened 3 years ago, 5 years ago, but having a real-time understanding of what's going on and what you're seeing from the standpoint of draft information would be really good. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Kathy?
One question directed at Chief Pavlik. You had mentioned that the officer in question not only had these very questionable contacts, but also had been, as I think you said, generally performing below or at sort of average level. And it reminded me of a discussion I had some years ago when I was mayor of the city of Tacoma Park. The city council had a discussion with our then police chief about hiring practices. At that point, the city was trying to hire officers for openings that we had in our police department. Of course, our police department is quite a bit smaller than yours. We had 41 sworn officers. And some of the council members were putting pressure on the chief to relax the standards that she had for hiring. I was quite opposed to that, and I'm pleased to say that she did not do that. But in the course of the discussion, she talked about the hiring process, which, you know, because this is a Maryland police department, had to go through all those screens that you talked about. But in addition, in order to be hired, an applicant had to have a very lengthy and detailed interview with the police chief herself. And she told us that she felt free, if even if the person had passed all the screens, if she simply felt that they weren't right for the kind of policing that Tacoma Park did, she felt free to reject them. And she told us that they rejected, that they hired less than 1 out of 10 of all applicants. Now, some of them were screened out in earlier parts of the process. And so I guess I have a couple of questions for you. One is, does hiring officers in your department, does that involve a detailed interview with either you or some other very senior officer in the department? First question. The second question is, do you know what percentage of people who apply actually get hired?
Yes, so the first question is, they do go through an oral interview panel that's usually chaired by a sergeant and lieutenant and then two officers. Every packet that comes to my attention for signature, I do have the authority to override someone who approves them for hire. I am the final stop. So I will review the entire background file, psychological file, criminal check, you know, the whole, we call it a six-sided monster because how big the folder is. But I review that, and I'm the final authority on who gets hired or not. As far as the interview process, you know, it's a great idea, but I'll give you an example. This past weekend, we had a test. We had 108 people show up for the written test. Out of that, 28 people passed it. And then we go to a physical test, and out of that, only 20 people passed that. At the end of the day, we do a preliminary background screening right then and there as part of day one. We moved 18 people through that process. So the success rate, you know, is less than 10%.
Paul? Paul, you're still with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Jack. Actually, Cheryl asked my question about the sharp curve, but I have another question, and it's one for Paul. Paul, one question I'm getting from constituents in the last few days, you know, when they hear about all these things happening, et cetera, now, these high-profile things, and we've heard this, you know, thorough update today on several of these issues, their question is, so what does this mean for SafeTrack? Is SafeTrack going to have to be modified, and specifically, you know, the timeline? So is there any general update on that?
Yes, Bob. I'm going to put in a larger context.
Again,
safety is the priority. So, you know, we created the SafeTrack plan, what we knew at the time. We were pursuing that. But as we learn more information, we are going to have to adjust all the work that we do. So on the safe track, we have readjusted 8 and 9. We're going to come out in mid-September for the next round of safe track surges, and we'll lay that out so people have the timeline to adjust. But, yes, I mean, we've already added 6 crossovers that we will be doing where we'll be shutting down on weekends. And, again, as we find anything we find out there, that is how we are now responding. And, again, I will just, again, cite the example a few days ago, where, you know, if we find an issue, we're going to get it in there and do what needs to be done and not Band-Aid it. And that is the approach that we're taking.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a couple of questions and talk about a couple of things based on my experience at Federal Railroad Administration. First of all, I'm very happy to hear that you're looking at automated track and possibly machine vision to find defects, and I think that this may be a very good way forward. FRA has an automatic track inspection fleet that we use on the railroad system, and we also have available technology that lets us do a much more effective job of track inspection. And this may be something to consider as you try to determine, you know, how many inspectors you need and how much track time you need. So I'm very happy to hear that you're looking at that. Some of the things that were brought up when your experience as a rail maintainer before you become a track inspector, that's actually a federal requirement for FRA's railroads. So that's in place. On oversight, I want to talk just a minute about oversight because you do have human factor issues, especially with past red signals. And I didn't hear a lot about oversight. I mean, actually observing folks actually take the right action. And then I know on one of these incidents there was an issue that a train left the doors were closed before a lunar signal was provided, and that's one of the WMATA policies, that the doors don't close until you get the lunar, the clear signal, and can proceed. And that, to me, seems like something that a manager could be on the platform and actually observe that very easily. Do you do any of that oversight of these train operations as part of the response to these red signal passings?
There is an efficiency testing program in place. I don't think it covers all the areas we need to cover. It's being revised, and I believe it's supposed to be rolled out in late September, early October. And one of the things would be to look at this performance monitoring. Are we doing it in the correct sequence? Are we overspeeding? All the things we should be looking at. So I agree with you that we need more efficiency testing, and that's in the works.
And just to compare with what FRA does, efficiency testing is required of all the Class 1 railroads. They have to do the testing. They have to report back to FRA on how many violations they found. And so if we can provide any help from on those programs, we'd be happy to do that if you have any questions on that. Finally, we talk a lot about safety culture. And safety culture, and this is just me talking in my career as a safety professional, safety culture is like graduate school. You got to do all the elementary things before you even get to the point where you talk about having a good safety culture. And from everything I've heard and seen, to me the key is doing the fundamental items. And this is on track. This is finding the defects, documenting them, prioritizing them, and fixing them. And I think, is really where the emphasis needs to be right now. I think you build a safety culture by making sure that everybody does these fundamentals. And things like gauge rods. When I talk to my track inspectors, gauge rods are a Band-Aid. They're something that's supposed to be put there temporarily, just long enough so that you can get the crew out there to fix the issues. And so I think when those things start happening, when you start doing the fundamentals, when you start using the technology or the tools appropriately, I think you're basically setting the stage to build a safety culture. And again, Christian's absolutely right. Safety culture is not something you get overnight. You don't get any kind of culture overnight. It's something that builds and builds and builds. But those fundamental things need to be done first. And I congratulate the three of you. You know, right now, you're the fresh eyes. You're part of the solution. And maybe in 4 or 5 years, you might be part of the problem again. I don't know. But you're doing the right things, and I want to congratulate you and thank you for the good information that you're providing. You seem to have the same concerns that at least I'm seeing, and we'll do all we can to help you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That concludes our second and final round of questioning. I want to take this opportunity to thank Paul, Joe, Pat, and Ron for all the good information you've given us today. I want to thank all of the board members for your participation, all the members of the public and others who had an opportunity to sit in. I would like to ask all board members to as quickly as you can, go upstairs. We have an executive session, a presentation that is awaiting us. So the faster we get upstairs, the better. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Okay, thanks, everybody. I'm coming.